everyone, and welcome to Minute 58 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1980 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and once again we're on location here in Baltimore, and my host/guest is, once again, Nick Rehack. Thank you once again for letting me stay.
Of course.
It's been a lot of fun.
It has been. The weather's been a little hot, but outside of that, I've been...
Well, the weather outside is frightful, isn't it?
But the...
Dum-de-dum delightful.
The air conditioning inside is so delightful. Ooh.
Yeah. So, my guest is Nick Rehack, formerly of French Toast Sunday. So, thank you once again for joining us on this lovely Wednesday morning.
For sure.
So, episode 58 begins with Al closing the squad car door. And ends with a man talking about Wolfgang.
Yeah, of all things.
Yeah, seriously. Wolfgang. Which Wolfgang could it be? Amadeus? Who knows? So yesterday we ended the episode with Al walking towards his car and, you know, continuing to hum and sing incorrect or out-of-order dialogue, out-of-order lyrics. You know, but still nice and fun. He's in a very happy mood. He gets in the car, continues to close the door, and he continues singing. You know, he's ready to go have his Twinkies and go home.
He's jolly.
He's very jolly. And that makes sense. I mean, it is Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
You know, he's bearing gifts for his wife, for his pregnant wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Twinkies. So, there you go. So, then they give us a great shot of his hand on the gear shift.
Yeah.
You know, because we see the shot from below, and then we see, like, a shadow fall down onto the car, and it turns out that it is a body. And, you know, it lands, and the head goes right through the windshield.
I mean, just perfectly.
Yeah.
Perfectly through. It's almost... And it's weird how it happens, too, because you wouldn't think it does, but I guess as it hits and it slides in for some who knows what reason, but it is.
No, but how does he stay prone like that, like he's flying? You know, you'd think that if you throw a body out the window, it's not going to land, you know...
Flat like that. It would catch
it would have tumbled,
spin.
it would spin. You know, again, he jumped 34 floors, or he's been thrown 34 floors. You know, we can easily see that it is Marco, based on his clothing.
Yeah.
You know, who he... is dressed very differently than all the rest of the terrorists / bad guys, however you want to refer to them in this movie, because we all know at this point that they're not really terrorists. But, you know. And, I mean, first of all, it's an amazing effect the way they do it. You know, the way that they get it to land perfectly on the hood and slam into the windshield like that. I mean, I wonder how many times they had to do that shot in order to get it right. Because... I mean, I doubt they used a stuntman for this. This must have been a dummy.
It had to have been a dummy. And one thing I really like, and this is going to sound weird, I like how the angle, and I like how the body falls. The angle, we're seeing it from below, and it just, out of nowhere, it hits. We don't see him being thrown. We don't see him being tossed. I remember at a very too young of age, really, in Lethal Weapon, at the very beginning, when the girl jumps out, and you just see her falling down, and then bam, land on the car, and... That has always been so striking and stuck out to me. So to see something
because she does a skydive, or because she's not wearing, because her shirt is open.
Because
I was young, mentioned earlier this week, very very impressionable young child watching that.
Yeah, but it's just the way it falls down, and you see a lot of it too. You'll see the shot of the whole body falling, and then, but instead we just get the suddenness. And then it's kind of that primer for chaos.
Yeah.
All of a sudden it hits, and then he's driving chaotically, and it takes off from there. Truly takes off from there.
Yeah. I mean, the way that it's done, they set it up really well. You know, I'm assuming that McTiernan is the one who gets the credit for deciding how to do that shot.
Yeah.
But it fits really well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mid singing... You know, Al just stops singing, and you know his car's already in reverse, but he slams on the gas and shoots backwards and goes, "Damn, God damn it, Jesus H. Christ!" You know, he starts screaming out of control, and then we get a shot of John, who's up on top, and he's looking down through the hole. Now, do you think that hole is big enough?
I don't think
I mean,
it
yesterday
is.
We were talking about the Iosaurin, but this is
That's not true.
I mean, it's a larger it's definitely a larger hole, but it's not a, the hole is not large enough for a body to go through it.
And here's the other thing.
Even if you were to, you know, wrap it up or you know you know, roll it up or whatever you want to call it, that is not big enough.
No. And the way the glass is peeling out, there's no way he didn't take the body and throw it at it head first. Now, if that's happening, I would think that as it falls down, it would start to tumble and kind of roll forward.
Exactly.
But it doesn't look like that because he lands, like you said, prone, boom, right on top, all splayed out. At no point is he spinning around doing any of that stuff. And it throws me.
It's not as if, you know, he was able to you know, grab him by the belt and grab him by the shirt and just, like, throw him out. Maybe that is what he did.
Could be.
No, but he does have a gun in his hand already.
Yeah, ready to go.
So.
And then so does a lot of other people that start shooting at him.
That's true also. But, yeah, that just, he does a nice, Superman impression here.
Yeah, very much so.
Of landing on the thing. And then I love John's, response. He screams out the window to nobody because nobody can hear him on the 34th floor. And he goes, "Welcome to the party, pal."
A classic line.
A completely classic line. Now, do you think, yesterday we talked about the term pal, you know, that Marco is the one who used the term pal. Do you think that basically John has an earworm and decided to use the term pal because Marco used it yesterday?
I'm thinking it's got to be a residual in there. Or, I mean, maybe in a weird way, he's shouting down to Marco.
Ah. But, I know it. I never thought about that. He's responding to...
Yeah.
I didn't think about that. He's not talking to Al. He's talking to Marco because Marco had said to him... He called him "No More Table Left, Pal," and now he goes, "Well, welcome to the party, pal."
But at the same time, I don't think his character would know from the 1700s version that it meant like partner in crime. Because in a way, Al would be his partner in crime, although be it anti-crime,
right?
In this case, but he doesn't know Al. He knows Marco. So to him, it's just another random cop guy because they haven't been speaking directly yet,
right?
So it's that thought came across my mind the other day. And it's just, it's stuck with me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, I never even thought about that. I've seen this movie so many times, and it's always been that he's basically saying, "Welcome to the party, pal," and I thought, and the reason I thought it was so amazing that he uses that phrase is because Al's name rhymes with pal. You know, and John doesn't even know that.
Right.
He's like, "Welcome to the party, pal, Al," or Al Pal.
Al Pal.
Or whatever it is, Al Powell.
Palimony.
Palimony, there you go. Al Powell, you know. And as the car spins backwards, we see like sparks flying out as you know the shots are being shot, and it hits like the police lights on top.
It hits everything. It hits the lights. It's hitting the hood. It's hitting just all kind. And they're just ringing out left and right, and it's chaos.
Right,
he's getting shot at.
But that's not John shooting at him. That's the
right. That's
thing.
The weirder part.
You know, I always thought, I always assumed it was John who was shooting at him, but it's not because it's at a lower floor.
Yeah.
And when we see John scream, "Welcome to the party, pal," he doesn't have his gun facing outwards.
No.
So, like, why would someone else be shooting at Powell at this point?
Yeah, it's who knows who it is. Exactly. I'm going to assume it's the others. But then even when he's way far back, they're still shooting at him.
But it's also from a very low...
Yeah. And not even on the 30th floor low.
Right.
Which is even weirder because, if anything, it would be coming from up top on the 30th floor.
Right.
So who or why would, and why, what would be the impetus to start shooting at him?
Right.
Now I'm confused.
Okay, now we know that we saw last week that Alexander was on a lower floor looking out, and Carl, Franco, and Fritz showed up there. We did see that. Okay, but we don't know what floor specifically, but it is a lower floor. But the biggest question here is why, if it is Alexander or one of the other three, even if it's Carl, why are they shooting? Like, what has caused them to start shooting? I mean, Marco landed on the car. Okay. And Pal, Al is, you know, flooring it and going backwards. But how is that, you know, causing any problems for the terrorists?
And we see they're watching him, too.
Right, because it's not as if he's shooting. Al isn't shooting. He's just screaming, and they can't hear him scream.
Yeah, and they're just in position, and then when he starts to drive, they aim down and start firing.
Yeah.
That's,
right. Makes no sense whatsoever.
No.
Right. Okay, so I first wanted to talk about, lights on emergency vehicles.
Mm.
Right? So what do you know about that?
I just know that fire is red and white. I know that police is red and blue. Around here for towing and or railroad type is going to be flashing yellow. Outside of that,
I just know that... What are ambulances around here?
Red and white.
Red and white, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so in emergency vehicle lighting is one or more visual warning lights fitted to a vehicle for use when the driver wishes to convey to other road users the urgency of their journey. To provide additional warning of a hazard when stationary, or in the case of law enforcement, as a means of signaling another driver to stop for interaction with an officer. These lights may be dedicated emergency lights, such as a beacon or a light bar, or there may be modified stock lighting, such as a wigwag or a hideaway light, and are additionally added to any standard lighting of a car, such as hazard lights. Often they're used along with a siren in order to increase their effectiveness. Okay, so the history of using lights began in Germany during World War II. Okay, they used blue emergency lights in order because they had blackout measures for aerial defense from 1935. They used cobalt blue, which replaced the red that they began to use for emergency vehicles.
Okay,
right. Blue had a scattering property. And makes it only visible in lower altitudes, and therefore less easily spotted by enemy airplanes.
Huh. Okay. That's interesting, and I wonder how they determined that color. You think they did tests where they're flying above and like, let's see how high
they're we can go before they did all the tested everything.
They know a thing or two about machines.
Yeah, apparently. But and there are different types of lights. Sometimes they use strobe lights. Sometimes they use LED lighting. And stuff like that. Sometimes they have signs that are made up of a large number of light sources, usually LEDs, which can be programmed to display messages to other road users. You know, on top of emergency vehicles. That's interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that. Where they have a message as opposed to, what would they say, pull over? You know, you'd read it backwards. You'd be reading it backwards.
The only thing I've seen on emergency-type vehicles are highway vehicles around here, big trucks. They usually just have arrows directing traffic and saying, hey, get over on this lane, and then kind of push you away from road traffic.
Because it's parked on the side.
Sometimes they're moving. So this way they're moving slow into the lane to get other people to move, right. And then they'll start to park. Mm-hmm. We also have big billboards above the highways, and they'll tell us, like, hey, there's a crash on such and such exit, silver alerts, amber alerts, etc.
Right.
But I've never seen one outside of that on an actual cop car or ambulance or anything like that. Because sure, they got squad numbers and station numbers, but that's like painted on. It's not like it's digitally and letting you know what's what. That's interesting,
right? So the car then that Al is driving backs up like really really fast, and he ends up destroying a parking pillar and then a light, and he continues going backwards. He's got his foot on the gas there, and then I love the shot they give us the view from Argyle.
The limo.
They're reminding us that Argyle is still there. He's on the phone,
oblivious,
laughing. We don't get to hear what he says, but it's just really really funny watching him just sitting there, through the whole thing. And we see Al's car in the background. Flying backwards.
And the body flies off.
Exactly.
Which is weird, because it goes up, but then immediately it gets caught by the branches and is pulled down.
Yeah.
Which is creepy.
Well, creepy for Marco.
Well, yeah, just grabs him.
I mean, you said yesterday that maybe he wasn't dead yet.
That's true.
That's even creepier.
It'd be really intense if he wasn't, though, because that's a lot. It's a lot to go through.
Yeah, apparently. Well, he deserved it.
Rightfully so.
He deserved it for teasing John yesterday. Come on.
John taught him a lesson. Don't tease me. Don't tease me, bro.
So, and I love that they switched the music for a second. You know, the sound goes out. We don't hear the car flying backwards. We hear the music that Argyle's listening to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it adds like some sort of comic effect.
Like a weird party element to it.
Yeah. So I like the way they do that.
All the leaves. And I like that when he finally kind of crashes and the vehicle stops, that there's that consistency that he has leaves. That he's pulling the leaves off of him. There's leaves falling out of the car.
Those aren't leaves?
That's not leaves?
I thought those were... Oh, those are leaves?
Yeah.
I thought those were Twinkies.
I could see that too, actually, but no, I always thought it was leaves.
I was sure those were Twinkies.
No, I always thought it was leaves.
I thought he like crumpled up the Twinkies because of everything that was going on. Oh my God. Wow. The two of us really saw different things there.
Were you hungry when you were watching this?
No, not at all, but I've seen this so many times. I always thought that you know, are you sure those are leaves?
It looked like leaves to me.
Did he go through yellow leaves at some point?
Yeah, look, it's definitely leaves. Yeah, because all the trees are like off.
But why is that inside the car?
Because the bus window's busted open.
Oh, good point.
Yeah, they come flying. Okay. Now, realistically, if you're going away, the stuff should be blown away from you, so there shouldn't be inside.
Right.
But there's some residuals in there. Okay, all right.
You see, you taught me something there. That's great.
Yeah.
I didn't even notice that before.
I kind of like the Twinkies thing.
No, I always thought he like mashed up the Twinkies. Oh, wow.
I like that. I'm going to stick with that.
Yeah, why not? Why not? And, you know, the car is still careening backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's more shots being fired at it. And, you know, there's still more sparks and everything like that. And he's screaming in the car the whole time. He's going, now means now, goddammit. Policeman under automatic rifle fire at Nakatomi. I need backup assistance now. Now, goddammit, now. And as the car goes backwards, it passes this big sign that says Nakatomi Plaza Hotel and Convention Center. And they have the names here of the contractor and the architect. And some of these are names of people who are part of the movie. So we talked weeks ago about Bruce Gefeller.
Mm-hmm.
So it has here, and that was a name that I thought was made up, but it really is. So it's Gefeller Construction.
Yep.
They decided to give him a credit here.
And it's, some of these guys, I actually Googled to see if they were real people, and it was like an inside joke bit, or if it was staff, and I couldn't find. But what I should have done was gone on IMDb and run like a side by side comparison. But like, okay, I literally wrote like EC Chen Architect. I got nothing.
All right. Well, these guys are mostly in the art department.
Okay, makes sense. We have
Roland Hill is the set designer. Okay. Bruce Gefeller is the construction coordinator. All right. I'm not sure which. Steve Callis is the construction foreman. Okay. E.C. Chen is the set designer.
He's the architect.
Yeah. And the only one that I can't seem to find is Al DiSaro. I don't know who that one is. But all the others are... Oh, and I...
It says, I think it says mechanical above his name, so maybe he does like prop stuff or.
Okay, well, Ed Ayer, A-Y-E-R,
mm-hmm.
is the gaffer.
Ah.
All right. And.
Not a lot of love for gaffs, typically.
And Al DiSaro is the special effects coordinator. There you go. Okay. All right. So every single one of them is part of the movie. Okay, so it basically they tell you the architect is E.C. Chen. The general contractor is Gefeller Construction. Mechanical is Al DiSaro & Co. The electrical is Ed Ayer Co. The civic architect is Steve Callis. And then the executive architect is Roland Hill. So, yeah. We only see this sign for a fraction of a second. But it's great that all six of these people are part of the crew.
Yeah, it's a fun little Easter egg.
Yeah, it's a fun little Easter egg that they just threw in there. Which works really, really well. You know, and the car continues to roll, and it plows through a gate, and then it lands pointing upwards on a lower embankment. And as you said, he opens the door, and he's got all these leaves there, which look like Twinkies, but they're not. So he opens the door, and he gets out, and, you know, at this point, the shot changes, and we see a man who, if you've seen Ghostbusters, you've seen him before, but in this movie, we haven't seen him yet. And he's talking on the phone, and he basically says, "Monica, I can get us a table. Wolfgang and I are very close." And that's actually how this minute ends. So, is there anything else you wanted to say about this minute besides the leaves slash Twinkies?
I don't like the guy at the end. Anytime, like, when he gets introduced as a character, I just, immediately I know I'm not going to like him.
You're saying just because?
Just seeing him on the screen, I know I'm not going to like him. I know there's something, not fishy, but there's something off about that guy. Something I'm not going to like.
You're saying that William Atherton has never been in any movie that you've liked him in?
I'd have to look and see what all he's been in. Because when you said, oh, he's been in Ghostbusters, I'm like, ah, it's not ringing any bells. Not Ghostbusters ringing bells, but that actor and being in Ghostbusters,
he's
it's
the,
not.
He's the guy who all the marshmallow falls on at the end. He's the one who turns off the, you know, the containment system.
Oh, see, I don't like that guy.
Right. Okay, no, Ghostbusters for sure. I mean, he has 39 movie credits, so I wonder if there's... There's got to be something that he doesn't play. You know, let's see. He was a bad guy in Real Genius also.
Yeah.
He both Die Hards. He was in the Pelican Brief, but I don't remember him in that movie.
He must have been in there briefly then.
Yeah. He was in The Last Samurai.
Okay.
Playing the Winchester rep.
No, he's probably not a good guy.
No,
I'm sure the actor himself is a good person, but he also does good at playing, like, sleazy guys.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently that's
his forte.
Yeah, apparently. And he's good at it. He's good at it. And he mentions Wolfgang. Now, do you know, which Wolfgang do you think he's talking about?
As soon as he says reservations and Wolfgang, I'm immediately thinking Wolfgang Puck the chef.
Yeah, correct. What do you know about him?
He's a chef, and he's world-renowned, and he's, like, a big deal. Like, if there was a Mount Rushmore of chefs, I'm sure his face would be on it.
Right. Okay. So, his full name is Wolfgang Johann Puck.
Nice.
He was born July 8th, 1949, which means that as of recording today, he's 73.
Mm.
Right? He's an Austrian-American chef and restaurateur. He was born in Carinthia, Austria. He learned to cook from his mother, who was a pastry chef.
Okay.
And he decided to actually take his stepfather's last name after his mother got remarried. And that was where the name Puck came from.
Okay.
He had two younger sisters and a younger brother. And then he trained as an apprentice in Monaco at the Hotel de Paris. And at the...
Fancy.
And at Maxime's Paris before he moved to the U.S. in 1973 when he was 24.
Whew.
So he,
what a different world.
Yeah, he began it to be a chef in Indianapolis, and then he moved...
I'm sorry. He goes something like Monaco and Paris, and he's like, now I'm in Indianapolis. You would think like L.A. or New York or Chicago or, you know...
Well, it wasn't there yet.
Bigger ones, but Indianapolis. How do you pick that one?
Yeah, and then at the age of 26, he moved to L.A.
There you go.
And became the chef and part owner of Ma Maison Restaurant.
Wow.
And as you mentioned, he is one of the people that everyone knows. You know, if you're talking about chefs.
Yeah, culinary and all that.
Right. He has opened numerous restaurants.
Mm.
There are over 20 fine dining restaurants that each of them are part of the top 40 restaurants in the U.S.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to one before?
Well, I only kosher, so no.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Nope, never been there. You know, but even if I could go, I don't think I would have the money to pay for
absolutely not for
one of those.
It'd be meals. Absurd.
You know, I'd rather save my money. You know, something a little cheaper.
Yeah, that I'm sure tastes as good, if not better.
Yes. Yeah. I don't need other garnishings. I just want the food to taste good.
Yeah.
It doesn't. To me, it doesn't have to look fancy. It has to taste good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to look like crap either. That,
no, of course. You know, like, I mean, dog food.
There is something in between.
Right, right.
You know, there's a lot in between. That's for sure. He has... His recipes have been syndicated in newspapers and on websites since 2003.
Syndicated?
Yeah. Okay. And he's very active in philanthropic endeavors and charitable organizations. He co-founded the Puck Lazaroff Charitable Foundation in 1982, which supports American Wine and Food Festival, which benefits Meals on Wheels. Hmm. And they've raised more than $15 million since it was created.
Wow.
Yeah. So his original, one of his most signature dishes at his original restaurant, Spago, is the house smoked salmon pizza.
That sounds really good. Especially that it's on a pizza.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. He has received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Really?
Yep. It's located, anyone who goes there, it's located at 6801 Hollywood Boulevard.
Do you know who he's between?
No.
Okay.
That I don't know. Well, you can look it up. It's,
that's
know,
true.
6801, and who's at 6803 and 68, I don't know. I don't know how that works with the address.
Huh.
So yeah, he's won numerous awards, and he's just definitely one of the top known chefs in the world. So that's very interesting. So is there anything else you wanted to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No, I think it's one of the more chaotic minutes. Early on in the film, obviously, as we get towards the end and it ramps up, it gets way chaotic. But this is definitely the catalyst. This is like, all right, we're really not playing around now. It's about to really get amped up.
Right. All right, so the script has another, as always, a few minor discrepancies. There's nothing major here, but it's still always nice to read it. You know, he actually screams into the radio, Jesus H. Christ, 6421, this is 1 out of 10. You know, like, he actually... It's funny that he actually in the script has the wherewithal to, you know, to actually notify someone, you know, about what's going on, you know, that type of thing. And then it says suddenly a barrage of machine gun fire from Alexander on the third floor drowns out his call.
Okay.
Powell ducks and flattens against the seat as bullets blow out the front window, covering him in glass. But didn't
Marco, it's already blown out?
Didn't Marco blow out the front of the? So yeah, I don't know. And then the dispatcher goes, Roger, please repeat. And then it says, but Powell accelerates in reverse away from the building, keeping his head low and praying he doesn't hit anything as the bullets follow him, digging into asphalt. A half block away, his car runs off the pavement and down a slope, finally bouncing to a jarring halt in a parking lot, which is destined to become police headquarters a few pages from now. Powell sits up and clutches the mic. 1 out of 10 under automatic rifle fire at Nakatomi requesting immediate backup and SWAT assistance. You know, it sounds a little too formal the way that he says it in the script.
And a little, like, redundant.
Yeah, but like, also you don't less need chaotic.
Yeah, you know, yeah, absolutely.
As you mentioned, this is a very chaotic minute.
Yeah.
And it works as a chaotic minute. And for him to calmly, or he's probably not that calm saying it, but he's got his thoughts collected here, which... We don't want it. We want the spontaneity of it all.
Right.
You know, that's what it comes down. And then it does have Welcome to the Party, Pal. That's in the script. And then the shot changes and it goes wide in from a police scanner. We take in the action here. All color coordination and slickness. Richard Thornburg, local TV news reporter, is on the phone to his girlfriend. And then he says into the phone, of course I can get us a table. Wolfgang and me, we're like that. I interviewed him. Hold on, babe. He covers the mouthpiece because he's become aware of what's coming from the scanner. Now, the script makes him too polite. You know, he actually tells his girlfriend to hold on.
Yeah.
You know, in the movie, he doesn't do that at all.
No. What a jerk.
Yeah, seriously. But, yeah, that's pretty much how... those are the discrepancies in the script. They're minor, but, you know, they still work. So every Wednesday we have a segment called Hans Hump Day, where my guest gives their top five performances of Alan Rickman. So what have you got for us? Start from number five and work your way up.
My number five is going to be Love Actually. I know it's more of an ensemble film, but he to me, Alan Rickman has always had this charisma and power on screen that when he's on, like, he's the one you're paying attention to. And even though he's in this a little bit, the way he can convey the relationship that he's having in the film and how it's kind of drifting apart and he's kind of looking at other things, especially with his eyes, it like really grabs you. And even though he's being the character he's being, kind of a like sleazeball kind of guy, it's still like you feel for him. You're kind of on his side in a weird way, but you don't want to be on his side, right. kind of thing.
Right. I mean, I actually saw Love Actually just a few days ago. Mm-hmm. I watched it again. And I completely agree with you on that. I mean, his secretary is the one who's pursuing him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't say no. He should be saying no.
Yeah.
But she's the one who's very active the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's passively dealing with it all, which, again, is wrong.
Yeah.
But... you know, you still feel for him because here he feels that something's going wrong with his marriage, and yeah. okay, here's an opportunity, you know, opportunity knocks. But, you know, instead of having a, you know, heartfelt conversation with his wife to try and fix things.
Yeah, yeah. My number four is going to be Dogma. I enjoy Kevin Smith films. Not all of them, per se, because some of them, you know, they're not great. But to see Alan Rickman in there... it puts a smile on my face to see him. He's got that kind of... it just grabs you, you know? My number three is Sweeney Todd. He doesn't have the best singing voice, but there's something about it when he sings and kind of does that duet-ish with Johnny Depp. It just works. And I really like it. He plays kind of a... He's creepy... a little bit, but he's also kind of like conniving as well. But then you can see like he truly loves the girl that he's taken under his wing. I can't think of her name at the moment, but there's like a weird
Helena Bonham Carter?
No, the daughter. It used to be Depp's daughter, and now it's
right. I haven't seen Sweeney Todd in a very long time.
But yeah, there's just something about like the, almost like an unrequited love kind of thing, even though it's from a distance and he's a little creepy. My number two is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I just love that he's playing a depressed robot. The fact that a robot could just be like, oh, I mean, I guess, I don't know. It made me giggle throughout the whole movie. And then my number one is Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Where's Die Hard on this list?
It's not on this list.
Wow.
I like it, but I don't know. It's I'm sure it's in the top 10, but... it's not on this list for me.
Okay, that's fair.
His role in Azkaban, out of all of them, we start to see a little more humanity in Snape. The other films, he's just kind of this overbearing, for lack of a better term, just dick. But this one, we start to figure out, like, why. And we start to see motive, and we start to see him more as a person instead of just, you know, some really jerk of a wizard.
Yeah.
So, those are my five.
All right, cool. So, do you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Over on Twitter, at The Rehack, T-H-E-R-E-H-A-K. And, of course, I have a radio program over on Mixcloud.com. Really simple. It's called Rehack Radio. I'm playing the music that I like, and hopefully you'll like it, too. Some of it, there's fun facts behind it. There's stories. We dive a little bit deeper into the artist. But overall, it's just a good time and good tunes. Episodes usually clock in around an hour. And I try to keep them as safe for work as possible so you can play it at work and get other people to like it, and then they'll listen in, too.
What do you mean, safe for work?
There's songs where there's not, like, a lot of swears.
Oh, okay.
Like, radio-friendly stuff.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool. And while you do that, you can rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for A Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, or you can go to my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay!